Welcome, my name is Eric, and this is my podcast. Not in a creepy way.
Just like a constant punch in the balls until it's not.
Come on, don't ruin it for me.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from out of my head, who knows.
I mean, I just have nothing bad to say about pie. I'd recommend it to anybody for any reason.
Oh, come on.
Luckily it's on your end. Ha ha.
Oh, I was so much better before that knowledge. Thank you for ruining my evening.
It's okay. I'll just edit out my stupid comments.
Of course,
it'll be just fine.
Of course you will. You'll take it out in post.
Oh, welcome. I'm Eric, your brother Drew, as opposed to brother Jay, who has been on the show before. You suggested that we start talking about how we watch movies, like our style of watching movies.
Right.
So how do you watch a movie?
I am a fan of movies. I love watching movies, so I don't tend to be overly critical. When I watch a movie, I want to enjoy it, so I tend to look for the things that I will enjoy. You know, I can find a lot of enjoyment in bad movies, but if it's something that I do like and it does speak to me, I'll go deep on it. I'll listen to the director commentary. I'll watch all the special features. So those types of movies tend to be in a special category for me. If I had to compare my movie enjoyment experience, I always think of the guy in the movie Sideways, the buddy of the really wine connoisseur, who every time he sips wine, he always says is, it's pretty good. Well, that's me.
How about suspension of disbelief? Do you have any problem with that?
Generally not. You know, I understand that the whole point of watching a movie is sort of disappear into the universe of that movie, so I can usually go along with it.
Yeah, I think we're about the same on that. I don't think I go quite as deep as you do in some things. I think you were the one that turned me on to actually listening to director commentaries and things like that. And for a while I did that on a lot of movies, but these days, since a lot of the movies I watch are on a tablet, I don't have all that menu option that I would on a DVD. And kids changes all that movie watching experience for me, at least.
Yeah, life tends to get in the way a lot more now than it used to.
Yeah. But yeah, I like movies a lot too. And this movie in particular, and so let me give you a little bit of background on this. Creepshow, first of all, I love Stephen King and I love George Romero. And so this movie just seems unnatural. It was also playing either on whatever version of pay TV we had available to us at this point. I think actually I probably saw this movie first at our cousin's house because they lived in town itself and they had cable and we lived sort of out of town and had at that point, I think it was Multivisions, but either way, this was on heavy rotation and I'm sure we rented it from the video store quite a bit. And it was just, it's just fun. It's just a fun movie. It's done in the style of the EC comics. And so it's super stylized and they use a lot of the comic book frame conventions. And also what I enjoy about it is that they use the titles and frames and then they do split screen sometimes, which is very clever to use the comic cell technique there. And then they also tint the movie or use different colors in the background or even just the whole frame will be tinted to denote whatever action is going on or whatever mood they want to set, which is, I think it adds to the whole feel and it's very clever. And the music is pretty melodramatic.
Yeah, I actually made a note about the color scheme. So I hadn't remembered it from watching it when I was a little kid, but it really jumped out at me at this last rewatch.
Yeah, and it just, to me, it just works. I mean, if I'd compare it to like if you, like the movie Sin City, has a very comic book style to it, very similar to the comic books, the black and white comics that it was referring to. You know, this has, I guess, a lot of those horror comics were black and white, but even the colors were comic book colors that they used in this movie, which I thought was pretty great.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the story a little bit. First, there's, because this is an anthology film, there's a wraparound story that ties it all together. In this case, we have a boy by the name of Billy, who's actually played by Stephen King's son in the movie. He's credited as Joe King, but you probably know him as Joe Hill, the author.
Think that was Stephen King's son?
It was indeed.
That's funny. The first note I have is, this kid's a bad actor.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's horrible. It's, you know, I don't know. It's funny because there's a lot I'm going to forgive about this movie that I won't be so forgiving in the other ones. But yeah, that's definitely Stephen King's son, so that's why he got the job. Anyway, basically, he's got an abusive father, and the father is upset about his reading this horror comic crap, and that's kind of what sets the stage. And I thought it was, you know, it gives you a little bit of peril in there, and it kind of gets you into the comic book itself.
I told you before, I didn't want you to read this crap. I never saw such rotten crap in my life. Where do you get this shit? Who sells it to you? I'm talking to you, young man. You want to answer me when I'm talking to you. You remember who puts the friggin' bread on the table around here, don't you?
Stan, don't be too hard on him. All the kids read him.
My boy isn't all the kids. Want to know where this is going, Billy? In the garbage. Right into the friggin' garbage. Now, you got any smart mouth about that?
Now, it's any worse than the books you keep in your dresser, those ones under your underwear, those sex books.
Stan, you didn't have to
hit him. Not only do I find out he's reading this crap, he's a goddamn little snoop as well.
No, it wasn't like that! Stand for me to get your cufflinks on Sunday!
The windows are open downstairs. I better go down and close and the rain will get in.
No, I'll do it. I got some garbage I want to throw away.
Daddy, please don't throw it away. I'm sorry.
The next time, young man, I find you with a worthless piece of shit like this again, you won't sit down for a week, buddy boy. Remember that. Tuck in.
Yeah, if I can jump in there, I wanted to talk about the dad for a second.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was really freaking me out because he really seemed like he was, I mean, I recognize the actor, and what was unnerving to me about him is that he was missing a mustache. Like, I kept picturing him with a big, bushy mustache, and it took me until almost the end of the movie to remember where I knew that from. And I don't know if you remember, but he was the father of the jumper that started the movie Lethal Weapon.
I don't remember that. But, I mean, the actor is Tom Atkins, and I do remember seeing him in lots of places. But I didn't specifically pinpoint in that movie.
Yeah, so that made me think at some point we should talk about Lethal Weapon.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to revisit that because that was a weird and fun movie. And that was back when Mel Gibson was still a good guy for the most part.
And we saw that in the theater together.
Well, and yeah, that's we'll come back to our theater experiences, especially with these movies too. But okay, so you want to go to the first of the stories? So we'll set up the first one is Father's Day. This was written by Stephen King specifically for this film. What we have is a story about the patriarch of a family. Of a big family, rich family, I guess, who the remaining members of the family are gathering for Father's Day, as is tradition. And we have, because he has passed, he was actually, turns out, he was killed by his daughter, Bedelia, who's played by Vivica Lindfors. And I had some sort of history about her, but since I don't have it right at my hands, I don't know. I just think she hams it up pretty well. Anyway, so she comes to celebrate her father in her own special way. And then her snotty relatives are also there, including the granddaughter and then some great-grandchildren. And the only real notable actor in this whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the great-grandchildren's husband is played by Ed Harris. A very young Ed Harris.
With hair.
Yeah, it's a little crazy. The idea of the story is Bedelia arrives. She goes out and has her little, drunken remembrance on the grave. And then through the magic of movies, the father, you know, comes out of the grave and wants his cake that he never got on Father's Day, which is the day that she had killed him so many years ago. And that's kind of what the story is about. Just basically it's a zombie movie, a zombie story. And I mean, I thought it was fine. You know, it was probably the weakest of the stories maybe, but it was a nice little introduction to all the stylistic things they were doing. And you get the biggest horror element, besides some pretty good special effects with the zombie thing and the coming out of the grave, was you get to see Ed Harris dancing.
I had a note about Ed Harris dancing. That was maybe one of the scariest things in the entire movie.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was uncomfortable.
Yeah, this story was, it didn't really evoke a lot of memories with me, so it certainly didn't resonate over the years. I generally had the feeling that I'd seen it before, but it wasn't overly familiar to me like a couple of the other stories were, and I'm not sure what that says, but when I was watching it for this discussion, it was the first sign to me that this was purposefully made like a B movie. It was very, very campy. It was the first time that I noticed the comic book effects within the story that you're talking about. And there was definitely a very strong blue color tone to this story that made everything look a little bit more eerie than it probably really should have been.
And the acting in the whole thing is pretty melodramatic, which again, to me, you know, it goes with the whole theme of the comic book, you know, style of the whole thing. But between that and the score is pretty melodramatic. But yeah, I mean, I thought this was just, you know, it was a pleasant introduction, but yeah, it wasn't, other than the quote, you know, about it's Father's Day, where's my cake? You know, it sort of ended on it's Father's Day. I got my cake, and I don't know. I mean, it was fine, but it wasn't anything that, yeah, to write home about, really.
Where's my father's cake? I want my cake, you dirty bitch. I'm going to have it. Father's Day. Where's my cake? You promised me my cake.
Yeah, I mean the big gotcha moment at the end with the cake being the head. It wasn't particularly scary. It seemed a little silly.
Father's Day. I got my cake.
Oh my God!
Happy Father's Day.
But it was also it also set the tone that this wasn't really like a your typical horror trope. You know, it wasn't like a morality tale. It was just really one of those old-style short stories that was meant to give you a little bit of a jolt.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. And actually, I don't know whether you remember this or not, but, you know, I think a better head on a platter scene, a more effective sort of scary, creepy head on a platter, they did on some sort of Halloween episode of Little House on the Prairie.
No memory of that.
Okay, well, let me tell you. I think it's Mrs. Olsen's head and it ends up on a platter. Freaked the crap out of me as a kid. Anyway, that's a total digression. So, next we have, I think a little bit of a stronger story, but that's perhaps I should wait and judge in a second. And that's The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill. And this is pretty simple. This is three actors total, and really basically the whole thing rides on Stephen King, who plays this sort of country bumpkin farmer guy who lives out on a trailer, and he finds a meteor that lands on his property, and he ends up trying to pick it up so he can maybe sell it to the university for a couple $100. But it cracks open, and he gets, well, the quote is meteor shit on him. And that leads to him growing all this plant sort of stuff on him. And it actually ends super tragic where he kills himself at the end. And then the whole world is going to die, or, you know, the, at least that's the impression that I think it, it left me.
Yeah, that's funny. The impression that I was left with was, this really cemented the feeling to me that this was a B-movie horror slash comedy.
It definitely had some campy, fun moments, but, I mean, to me, this was like a direct H.P. Lovecraft, The Color Out of Space. I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but that this is pretty much it. I mean, or I guess Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Sure.
Yeah, but I would recommend The Color Out of Space. It's pretty cool. In fact, The Color Out of Space was kind of the inspiration for James Campbell's Who Goes There, which is the direct inspiration for John Carpenter's The Thing. So, anyway.
Yeah, I honestly didn't enjoy this story, the death of Jodie Verrill, very much at all. I didn't like Stephen King as an actor. I actually remember watching this one when I was a little kid and wondering, why does he keep sucking on his fingers? Like, that didn't seem like a natural thing to do. If you touch something weird and you hurt your hand, why do you keep sucking on it? So that didn't resonate with me. I didn't enjoy watching Stephen King act. That was pretty terrible. I think a cameo would have been fine, but watching him have to go through a whole story was pretty rough for me.
Yeah, well.
One thing I did enjoy was, did you notice the ashtray from the first story was in here?
I didn't notice it. I mean, I read about it, but apparently it appears in all sorts of stories on this.
I think all of them, yeah.
Yeah, at least it was thoughtful. I liked the story, actually, just because, again, it reminded me of The Color Out of Space, but I also liked it because it's dark. I mean, for all the goofiness in it, and I guess, you know, Stephen King can be accused of mocking country folk, but it's dark. I mean, he kills himself, and the whole world is going to succumb to this thing, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, no, it certainly had another, you know, gotcha ending. But the journey just was not pleasant for me to get there.
Yeah. Well, okay, so next we have Something to Tide You Over. And this is probably my second favorite of them, just from a style and an effects standpoint. What we have, again, this is only three people, too. This is... a rich guy named Richard Vickers, played by Leslie Nielsen, who at this period of time had been in a lot of those like police story kind of movies and was known for, you know, his comedic roles. But he has played a lot of folks. I mean, bad guys and good guys from other movies. And so, you know, I had forgotten that he's a pretty solid actor just in his own right. But then we have his unfaithful wife, Becky, played by Galen Ross, and then her lover, Harry Wentworth, who is Ted Danson, who is like right in the middle of the Cheers thing, I'm sure. So, you know, that was familiar to everybody at that point. Anyway.
This is before Cheers, wasn't it?
Is it? Well, okay, it's 83, so I'd have to look at that. But I guess by the time I saw it, I was familiar with Ted Danson from Cheers, so.
Yeah, I remember being familiar with Ted Danson because he was in Cheers, but I think that was at the very start of the Cheers run, and this movie had been out for quite a while at that point.
Well, there you go.
But yeah, you mentioned Ed Harris is the only acting heavyweight, but I think Ted Danson would disagree with you. He was a pretty celebrated actor during his time on Cheers.
Oh yeah, no, actually, I just meant Ed Harris was the only heavyweight in that first story.
Oh, yeah.
No, we have other heavyweights coming.
Yeah, Hal Holbrook won't be mad at you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, E.G. Marshall, too. But anyway, so back to Something to Tide You Over. This is a very, very simple you know, EC comic right up their alley. It's just sort of a revenge fantasy morality play thing where Leslie Nielsen's character basically forces the Ted Danson character to go out and dig himself a hole in the surf, and then he gets buried up to his neck in the sand, rather. And then they drag this TV out and this very, very long extension cord. And basically the rich guy has taken revenge on his cheating wife and now her lover, and they both die by drowning. And then he goes back to his home, and it's, I was surprised about how much time he just sort of fiddles around at home before the real action starts. But eventually, Ted Danson and the wife come back from the grave and end up burying him in the sand, and he gets what he deserves. The biggest thing about this was the special effects as far as the color tinting was really great. And also the sound, like with their voices when they were talking, you know, because they had that, you know, that coming from the water sort of sound going on. I thought that was pretty effective. And the special effects were actually pretty good too, as far as the zombie or revenant.
I can hold my breath for a long time.
Yeah, I loved this story. This is the one I remember the most from being little. This one really, really stuck with me. Like I said, it's really simple. They don't ever explain why or how things happen. They just do. So you're experiencing it pretty much in real time along with the Leslie Nielsen character. And, it was really creepy. They really drew out his time at home alone, you know. We're at least halfway through Creepshow by now, so you know that this is a bad guy, and he's hanging out at home alone. So you know something bad is going to happen, and they just really draw it out, and they make you wait. And then he revels in what he's done. That was another fun thing, watching the dated technology he has with all the big cathode ray TVs he has and the giant remote controls and miles of cable that he needs. That was a lot of fun to watch. And then this one too, the ashtray was next to his bed. So that made it its third appearance so far. But, the zombies, the water zombies were pretty great. I think those effects held up really well. And there's the image of when Vickers shoots the zombies, and just black water seeps out of the hole, and they keep coming. That is probably the most iconic image that stuck with me over the years. You know, and they relentlessly just kept coming at him, and then you get that great comic book effect around his head as he just totally loses his mind because he just can't grasp what's happening to him. That was a lot of fun.
Well, and I think I heard this or read this someplace in a review, but, you know, the thing about the Leslie Nielsen character is he seems to know the rules about how you kill a zombie, and then when he shoots him in the head and it doesn't work, he is surprised, and that's what sends him right over the edge. It's like,
that's a good point. I didn't even think about that, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just one of those things where he's, you know, he doesn't seem quite as freaked out at the beginning of, you know, his seeing the zombies as when, you know, what he does naturally to defeat them doesn't work.
Yeah, he's defiant all the way to the end. I mean, he doesn't even die in the story. It just ends with him screaming about the fact that he can hold his breath a long time as the water is rushing in on him.
He still is going to get out of this, is in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, I thought it was, I mean, I actually, you know, there wasn't much in the wife department as far as acting. It's really just a two-person show. But I thought he and Ted Danson both did a fine job acting. I mean, he carried the whole thing. Leslie Nielsen did. But, you know, Danson did a pretty good job.
And he had awesome hair, Ted Danson did.
Well, of course. Now, was it his real hair?
I'm sure it was back then.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Yeah. Although it doesn't matter. It doesn't actually matter, does it? No, I agree. This is definitely a winner as far as the story, as far as I'm concerned. But my favorite story is next. By far my favorite story in this whole thing is The Crate. This is basically, it takes place on a college campus, and a janitor ends up finding this box from an Arctic or Antarctic expedition 150 years ago. And the box has what I guess is like a Yeti, maybe? I don't know. I mean, at the time, my memory of it, it didn't show the monster nearly as much as when I rewatched it and realized, oh, they show a lot of this monster. Anyway, this is a creature in it. But the fun part of the story is that the custodian who finds it then goes to one of the college professors, who's played by Fritz Weaver, who's been in a ton of stuff. And just as far as I'm concerned, does a great job acting this. And he ends up going down there with the custodian. They open it up. Custodian dies. The Fritz Weaver character runs and finds another, like a grad student or something, takes him down there. The grad student gets killed. So then he goes and visits his longtime friend, Hal Holbrook, who then has a diabolical scheme to use this creature to get rid of his domineering wife, played by Adrienne Barbeau. And it's a lovely little story.
Yeah, you totally skipped over the whole setup, the beginning part where Hal Holbrook is at the sort of college faculty party, and his wife is totally embarrassing and emasculating him, and he starts fantasizing about killing her in a variety of ways.
Everyone in the department is looking to put the knife in. I mean, some of these
so-called
academics make the shark in Jaws look like fucking Flipper.
Wilma!
Your husband's calling you, Billy.
Oh, God, Henry, what's wrong now?
Not a thing, Wilma. Everything's just fine.
Hell of a shot.
Bullseye. Oh, Henry, can't you do anything right?
Huh?
Huh? That's what I figured. Huh? That's just what I'd expect from you. I told you half an hour ago to get one of them kids in the monkey suits to bring the car around.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Henry, you are such a little kid. I swear to God you are. I mean, where would you be without me to take care of you?
Oh, yeah. No, he fantasized about killing her the entire thing. You're absolutely right.
Right.
Yeah, she does a great job. Adrienne Barbeau. I was trying to think. I can definitely think of Adrienne Barbeau as a certain type. But can you think of a modern version of Adrienne Barbeau? Who would be this generation's Adrienne Barbeau?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, see, I can't.
I mean, she's like a perfect like B movie actress for movies of a type that they don't really make anymore.
Yeah, well, and maybe that's why I can't think of someone who's like that, because, you know, she's pleasant enough, but she's not super attractive. I don't know. She pulls it off, and I think if I remember correctly, she was married to John Carpenter too.
No, that's a nice street cred.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, she was, you know, I totally remember her. I mean, you say her name and I can remember her. I don't even know what category to put her in. But yeah, one of the things that I wrote down when I watched this, well, first of all, it turns out, you know, I thought this at the time, I thought this was the greatest special effects that you could see on some sort of TV movie thing that wasn't, that wasn't John Carpenter's The Thing. But on review, I think the Something to Tide You Over has better special effects. And this is just a guy in a monkey suit for the most part. And I think they could have done it better if they had shown less of the monster.
Yeah, I have the opposite memory that you did. I thought they had showed the monster a lot more than it ended up showing. One of the things that I thought was fantastic about this story was just how well they kept ratcheting up the tension in the early part. You know, they certainly spent a lot of time setting up how Holbrook's relationship and his marriage and how miserable he was. But also when they found the crate, it took them forever to get to the point with the first sort of bloodshed. And even when they were opening the crate, when they were going through the process of trying to pry it open, popping off the nails, it took so long. And the entire time, you just had the sense of dread that something bad's going to happen, but they do not let you off the hook.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely... I mean, the story is called The Crate, so you know there's something in that crate. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and again, and I remember when, you know, when they look through and they can see the eyes looking back at them. I mean, I remember that vividly from when I saw it originally, but I guess that's the part I remembered more than actually seeing, like, the hand come out and that kind of thing. And then at the end, they showed, like, the whole, you know, frontal view of the whole thing. Have you read The Shining?
No.
Okay. And in the movie The Shining, I don't think it's as big a deal, but I think this is a Stephen King thing. The relationship between Dexter Stanley, who's the Fritz Weaver guy, and Hal Holbrook, who's Henry Northrop, they have like a relationship that is very interesting, I think. And I think that Stephen King must have had this relationship with somebody like during his collegiate travels or something, or maybe he wished he had one, because in The Shining, there's the relationship between Jack Torrance and then Al Shockley, which I think is very similar to the relationship between these guys. But again, if you haven't read it, it's not really worth talking about. I just like the fact that, you know, this is like Hal Holbrook's best friend or whatever, and that's why the guy comes to him, and yet Hal Holbrook, you know, drugs him so that he doesn't get in the way of using this opportunity to dispatch the wife.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on anything particularly special about their relationship, except they were longtime colleagues. They liked to play chess together, and Hal Holbrook, he saw the opportunity to finally make a positive change in his life.
Definitely. I mean, the solution came to him, and he used it. And it's also one of the more sinister stories, because other than being emasculating and kind of a horrible person, like personality-wise, it's not like Adrian Barbeau deserved to get eaten by a monster. I mean, Hal Holbrook's the bad guy in this whole thing. Everybody has clean hands but him.
Yeah, well, there's a weird sort of early 80s cavalier attitude about the Dexter Stanley character maybe abusing, maybe raping some college girl that seemed to titillate the Adrian Barbeau character. I mean, that's how she was lured there.
Yeah, you're right, because he obviously has some sort of drinking or substance problem. I assumed it was a drinking problem, because when he goes to get, after the custodian gets killed, he goes and runs into that grad student who just assumes that his professor is just having, like, on a drunk bender and doesn't believe that there's really a monster down there, just thinks that, you know, he's seeing monsters instead of pink elephants. And, yeah, when Hal Holbrook tells his wife that, you know, you need to come down there, something really bad has happened, and, you know, she's really hurt and hiding, and he's really messed it up. Yeah, she seems very excited about that possibility and doesn't think that it's, completely believes that this has happened.
Wilma, I've had to leave in a hurry because of a call from Dexter Stanley. He seems to have gotten himself in a great deal of trouble. I'm ashamed to tell you of this, but ever since Dexter's wife died, he's had problems coping with certain young female grad students. He's been able to cover up several incidents, but this one looks very serious. It seems he got a young woman to accompany him to Amberson Hall under false pretenses and then attacked her. When Dex called me, he was barely coherent. He was gibbering with fear and crying, I think.
Aw, poor Dex.
I tried to get him to tell me what had happened to the girl, but for the most part, he only kept repeating, "It's awful, Henry. It's awful." Wilma, could you come out here? I know it's asking a lot, but you're always so clear-headed about these things, and you know how to be firm. I think Dex could use a firmer hand than mine right now. Not to mention the girl herself. He said that she had curled up in a dark place and won't come out. I'm sorry to have to ask you to come over to Amberson Hall and help me out. But as you so often say, what would I do without you?
What indeed, Henry? What indeed?
Well, I certainly didn't engender her any sympathy.
Oh, no, she's completely unsympathetic during the whole thing. I mean, like I said, it's not that I don't think I'm not crying any tears that her character died. It's just that unlike the morality tale convention, in this situation, she just gets killed because she's a bitch. She didn't actually do anything wrong. Yeah, but we're going to get to misogyny a little later in the next movie. But so anything else about the crate?
It did make me feel really old watching him sort of horse that crate around by himself. So I just kept thinking, yeah, he's really going to mess up his back.
Oh, definitely. All chained up and stuff. And then, of course, I like the fact that in this story as well, you know, the monster gets free at the end anyway. I mean, the monster in the crate is still out there, which is pretty nice. It's a nice little thing to throw into your horror story.
Indeed.
And then the last story is They're Creeping Up on You, where we have E.G. Marshall plays this, described as a cruel, ruthless businessman who has him living in this hermetically sealed apartment, controlled completely by electric locks, and he has surveillance equipment, and he basically has no human contact because of his fear of germs and whatnot. Of course, what happens is that he ends up covered in multi-sized or gigantic cockroaches and other bugs and dies an evil death alone. And it's just, as far as I'm concerned, it's effective and it definitely is memorable, but it's just gross. It's not, you know, it's nothing more than that. It's not, no other reason, nothing intellectual about it. It's just gross.
My question for you is, how many times did you think of this story when you were living in your apartment on B Street?
A couple, most definitely. Yeah, when I moved to the apartment on B Street and discovered that the magic of having roaches, even though we live in a state that's not known for having lots of bugs, yeah, it became a war of sorts.
Yeah, another thing I really enjoyed about this story, and it reminded me a little bit of the first story too, was just the caricature of the rich, you know, the upper class. Yeah, in the first story, the family seemed like what a lower middle class family would think of as an ultra rich family. You know, just a bunch of do nothings, sitting around abusing servants, waiting to be fed dinner. Yeah, in a similar manner, this story is what you would think of as maybe a lower class person might think of as a ultra ruthless businessman up in his ivory tower, ruining people's lives while making money. He had just no redeeming qualities. He received a phone call from a grieving widow, whose husband was driven to suicide, and he just brutally mocks her and tells her that her husband wasn't worth living anyway. So again, they set him up to be the villain, and you're kind of rooting for the roaches at that point.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, rich people do not fare well in horror stories. They get what they deserve, or they deserve what they get in the rules of the story.
Right.
Now, I guess another question is, were the roaches real?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I didn't think so until the very end, because there's a final shot where he's lying dead in his hermetically sealed panic room, and there are no bugs anywhere. That was an indication that he had just been crazy and couldn't get these bugs out of his mind and sort of drove himself to death by frying his own brain, which I thought probably would have been an even creepier ending.
Me too. I thought, end it right there. That's it. Just put the end on it.
Yeah, but then they went for another, you know, the final gotcha shock of the movie, well, at least of the stories, where the roaches start to crawl out of his body and I think, if I remember correctly, they almost filled up the entire panic room that you could see through clear glass.
Oh yeah, no, it was definitely at least halfway full. Yeah. And then lots of roaches still up on the, cause it was a panic room with, plexiglass walls, which is a strange choice, but oh well.
Good for movies.
Yeah, very good for movies. Yeah. Bad for cleaning though. You'd think it'd be hard to keep that stuff clean. Then again, you know, anyway. So yeah, again, I thought this was just, you know, it was fine and it went well with the whole thing, but it was just a gross out, rather than something a little bit more intellectually stimulating. Although none of these were actually all that smart. They were just fun.
Right. I thought this one was probably the funniest segment of them all. I mean, it's just so weird. And anytime he talked to anybody on the phone or that one weird guy who came to the door.
Yeah.
Like,
and then
I don't remember if he was the building handyman or what, but he just had a weird affect and didn't speak like a normal person. This is so bizarre.
Yeah. Well, and then got mocked by the guy at the end. It was like, what was that all about? You could have left that out too. If you just stopped it right when he was just dead, all by himself with no roaches around him. Lovely end to the story. But oh well.
Yep.
I have another problem about endings again a little bit later. But okay, so this is where we end up with the end of the wraparound story, where you have Stephen King's son. Well, what you have is you have two garbage collectors who find the Creepshow comic book in the trash because, you know, Tom Adkins without his mustache threw the comic book in the trash. These guys find it. The garbage collectors are Tom Savini and then Marty Schiff. And I think I read someplace that Marty Schiff may have been on the crew, like the special effects crew or something. He got that role because he was being paid back for something.
I recognize Tom Savini. That was a nice way to end the movie.
Yeah. And then he ends up, they find the book and see that the voodoo doll that they could have ordered, the little order form had been torn out because it had been used. And then, of course, what had been used for, the kid bought a voodoo doll and now was stabbing Tom Adkins, and who doubles over in agony, blah, blah, blah. As far as I'm concerned, it was a fine little wraparound story, you know, and it went with the comic book theme just fine. And I like the fact that in Creepshow 2, it starts with the comic book that comes out that theoretically the next issue has the comic portrayal. The cover is the comic portrayal of the kid in this movie using the voodoo doll.
I didn't notice that. I did notice in the beginning when the dad was screaming about comic books, he essentially did give a summary of the entire movie in about 12 seconds.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah, they referenced the book all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So it was simply a recounting of the comic book. But I don't know. Overall, I still, even though I think a lot of my fondness for it comes from nostalgia, I still think it's fun.
It's very fun. It's definitely more of a purposeful fun than I remembered. You know, when I watched it as a kid, I only viewed it in the eyes of a horror movie. I didn't have the sophistication to recognize that it was also poking fun at itself. So that was really interesting to realize on a rewatch, 30 years later.
Yeah, we're old. That's what that's all about.
Yeah, thinking about this movie also sent me sort of down a rabbit hole of thinking about how I came to appreciate horror movies, because you were big into horror since as long as I can remember, and you're I think what seven and change years older than me. So as a little kid, you know, I always looked up to you as my older brother, so I just wanted to hang out with you. And you spent a lot of time in our downstairs renting and watching horror movies. So I did too, along with you. And now that I think back, I mean, do you have any appreciation for how young I was when I was like sitting down in the rec room with you watching like the entire Friday the 13th series of movies?
Oh yeah, you were far, far too young. Yeah. No, I'm sure I didn't appreciate it at the time. Yeah, you didn't start any fires or anything, so it worked out okay.
Not that anybody knows about.
Well, there you go. Hey, there you go. Okay, so child abuse. I think the statute of limitations is over on that, but yeah.
Yeah, now that I have kids, I recognize how awesomely irresponsible that was. That was great.
One more thing about the original Creepshow before we put a pin in it.
Okay.
That movie had a fantastic cast. We didn't really address it directly, but I got curious about it after I watched it, and I was traveling, so I had lots of free time. If you added up all the actors, that movie had 10 Emmy wins, 27 Emmy nominations, 5 Oscar nominations, 5 Golden Globe wins, and 14 Golden Globe nominations.
Holy cow. No, that's amazing.
Yeah, that was a fantastic cast.
Well, and you know, the movie made money too. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I mean, it actually made its money just fine. It wasn't spectacularly successful, but at least it made its money. And I'm sure, and that's just in box office. I'm sure because of HBO or Showtime and those cable TV becoming much more popular during the time, I'm sure it was plenty successful, and so it was worth whatever large budget they had for it. Largish for its time. I mean, it wasn't a gigantic budget. Creepshow 2, 1987. We saw this in the theater.
Yes.
And you were probably still far too young.
I was probably 10.
Yeah. You were too young to see this movie. My God. As it turns out, because this is a movie that when I watched it, recently, I was shocked for like 3 different reasons. And there's only 3 stories in it. Well, let's just get down to it. This movie has problems to begin with. It starts off basically, I guess the idea is it started off pretty much just after the other one, because again, you have the comic that comes off of the truck. This time, the comic that comes off the truck itself that delivers the comic, the guy in the back of the truck is Tom Savini in a pretty bad mask. I mean, it really distracting. And voiceover, and it's, anyway. So the comic,
Did you think that was supposed to be the same kid?
Well, his name was Billy, but it shouldn't have been the same kid. I mean, the names were the same, but yeah, clearly a different kid, I hope. I mean, it could have been, I suppose, because there's no mention of his parents, but, I don't know.
Maybe all kids in the Creepshow world are named Billy.
Maybe so. Yeah, and they're all, like, blonde with bad haircuts. I'm not exactly sure, but... Anyway, so you've got this Tom Savini doing this crazy overacting, but then it totally becomes animation, and it's got a different animation style. I mean, the closest I could come up to it was like there was a movie, a 1977 movie, A Hobbit.
Heavy Metal?
Well, I was thinking The Hobbit, but Heavy Metal too, absolutely. And it was really heavy with that kind of animation. No split screens, no tinting. I mean, I thought actually technically the movie was shot. I mean, the movie's still pretty. It's actually shot pretty well. The lighting is great on it, and it's got it does what it does pretty well technically. But yeah, it doesn't have the fun little things that the first one did. And also, the wraparound story, you just have Billy getting the comic book. That's all. He starts to read this comic book. You don't care about Billy. Billy's not in peril in any way. There's no plot in this part of the thing. It just gets him to open up a comic. He might as well just be reading the whole thing. I was also a little bit disappointed that there were only 3 stories in this one instead of 5 like the first one. But it's okay because it makes up for it in several ways. Okay, so the first story is Old Chief Woodenhead. And I remember very clearly in the movie theater thinking, oh, this is not a great way to start. What you have is an elderly couple who own a store, in a small southwestern town called Dead River. And out in front of their store, they have this big cigar store Indian that they nicknamed Old Chief Woodenhead. And the couple are George Kennedy, who, by the way, is great. George Kennedy, as far as I'm concerned, is like the only serious actor in this movie. And then Dorothy L'Amour plays his wife, and I guess she's been in a ton of movies. And she does okay. She's just fine. Nobody else in this story acts very well at all. So they have this store. He's touching up the war paint on his cigar store Indian. They're old, and they don't have any children there, and the town has dried up, and his wife wants him to just sell the store and move, and he doesn't want to because he kind of owes the town. And then they get a visit by the chief of a local tribe, or an elder of a local tribe, that comes in, and in order to pay for the debt owed by the tribe in his store, the elder gives over some turquoise and silver, the sacred treasures of the tribe. And of course, George Kennedy says, no, but anyway, it's an honor thing. So he ends up taking the sacred treasures and he'll keep them for safekeeping till they can pay the bill back. Everything's just fine. Well, later that evening, one of the members of the tribe who has very long hair and wants to go to Hollywood and make him a name for himself comes in with his two skeezball friends, and they're going to rob the store. And during the robbery, they end up killing both the wife and George Kennedy. And then that wakes up Chief Woodenhead, who then goes out and gets revenge and eventually scalps the Indian guy with the long hair. Everything's fine. The treasures get returned to the Indian chief elder who picks them up, and Chief Woodenhead is holding the scalp of the bad guy.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time describing a story I did not enjoy hardly at all.
Yeah, me either. It wasn't, although I thought George Kennedy was pretty sweet, and I thought it was the way they shot it was really, it was like they used some sort of soft focus for the store and the town, and so, you know, it kind of gave you that sense of like old time values or whatever. But the acting was horrible, except for George Kennedy.
Yeah, no, it looked good. I think even old Chief Woodenhead looked good. I think the effects stood up. It's just the story. It was just not interesting and really horribly racist.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, I definitely thought when I first saw it, I was like, you can't even use a cigar store Indian like this anymore.
And the main bad guy, the Indian dude with the long hair,
uh-huh.
He looked really familiar to me when I was rewatching it. So I looked him up. He's nowhere close to being a Native American. He's this giant Irish dude who they just put a giant wig on. He actually had a series on FX for one season called Lights Out, where he played a washed-up Irish boxer.
Oh, that's funny. I did not know that at all. Did you look up the native elder chief, leader guy?
No.
Yeah. He is Mexican. In a long tradition of Mexicans playing Native Americans.
I did look up the fat toady guy because I was just wondering why he was in the movie at all. And turned out he's Hal Holbrook's son.
I was wondering because I saw the name, but that's hilarious. Yeah, it was pretty poor. All the way around, pretty poor. And there's not...
Yeah, there's nothing surprising about it. You knew exactly what was going to happen before the elder Indian guy even showed up. You could just see it coming. There's no surprises, no twists at all. It made me feel bad for George Kennedy. I think he thought he was in a different movie.
Oh, I think he was in a different movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because I thought, well, the first time I watched it again recently, I thought, you know, well, Dorothy L'Amour does a great job. Not really. No, he does the best job of all. She does fine. But yeah, everybody else, it's pretty, it's pretty local theater troupe kind of level of acting. But oh, well. It's pretty, though. Like I said, they did a good job with the cinematography. It's fantastic. Okay, so then we head to the next part of the wraparound story. It's funny. The first movie had the wraparound story that was just two parts, the beginning and the end. It was fine. This one has like 5 parts to the wraparound story, and none of it is interesting. But we'll just go there for the sake of ruining it for everybody, because you don't need to see this movie. Anyway, Billy goes to the post office. He gets a package that he's sent away from. The clerk makes fun of him. He says that he bought the Venus flytrap bulbs. There's something now interesting about Billy, but there's still no tension, and I still don't care. But it does get us to the next story, which is The Raft. Which, just by the way, in the theater, I thought, oh, this will be great. This is fantastic, because I remember the story from Skeleton Crew, the Stephen King book of short stories, and it's probably one of my favorite stories in that book. However, I'm going to have to reread the story, because there's some issues in this story. And we'll see if you agree.
I just have to say, 10-year-old Drew loved this story.
Excellent. It's interesting. Okay, so what we have is 4 college students, okay? In a Camaro or some kind of car. They're driving down to a local swimming hole. It's Deke, Laverne, Randy, and Rachel. Okay, Deke is the jock guy who, you know, fun-loving. You don't like him because he's too pretty and he's a jock, but that's fine. Laverne, who's sort of his skanky girlfriend. Randy, who's the hero of the story, the guy you're supposed to identify with, and he's the pre-med or medical student. And then another girl named Rachel, who, as I was watching it, even this morning I was watching it just kind of refresh, just to make sure that what I had in my notes was not too harsh. But you think that she's going to be like the virgin girl because she's the only one who doesn't like smoke to dope in the car, and she seems like a little uncomfortable to be there. Anyway, they drive down there. They're going to swim out to this raft and spend a whole day like smoking dope and hanging out in the water. Everything's fine. They go out there and they notice, or I guess Randy notices. Oh, by the way, just to skip back a little bit, in the Chief Woodenhead, when the guy with the Firebird in that story is sneaking out of the house, did you notice that the Cisco Kid was playing on TV?
No, okay. I don't think I would have recognized the Cisco Kid.
Well, they make a big deal about it. Oh, Cisco, oh, Poncho. Well, in this story, Deke and Randy call each other Cisco and Poncho, which I remembered from the story. But I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe they'll have the ashtray thing and they'll have Cisco and Poncho mentioned in the last story. No. So as they're swimming out, they notice this sort of oil slick looking thing start to, with intent, start moving toward the girls who are swimming behind the guys. And they yell at the girls to get on there, and it looks all very sinister. And what you've got is a nice little monster story of this oil slick thing, and they're stuck on the raft out in the middle of the lake. Seems perfect. And actually, for practical effects, it's actually done pretty well. I mean, there is one little thing where he says, you know, have you ever seen an oil slick that's perfectly round? Well, this is in no way perfectly round, but, you know, they used a tarp and put, like, leaves and gummy crap all over it. So, at the time, I think it looked fine. But, that's not the issue I have with the story. Then, let's see. The first person to get killed by the blob of stuff in the lake is Rachel, who is supposed to be the virginal girl. Although, you know, she starts to get loose and smoke dope and stuff on the raft, so that takes care of her being the final girl, and immediately gets killed anyway. So. That, to me, that was kind of shocking, I think. I didn't expect her to go first, but that's fine. Then they know they're really in peril, and there's the two guys and the girl left on the raft. And Deke, who's, of course, the bad guy, when Laverne starts to freak out, Deke threatens to punch her lights out or something, which I thought was pretty awesome for the time. Super misogynistic, but that's not my problem either with the movie, the show so far. Anyway, so one by one, Deke gets it, and that leaves Randy and Laverne still on the raft. And they're waiting out there, and it's getting dark, and they're trying to stay awake, and they're very cold, and the blob is kind of, you know, moved around a little bit, and so, you know, they're trying to stay awake. Well, she ends up falling asleep, and That's where we learn that Randy is a rapist. Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. Did that make you uncomfortable watching it recently?
Not really. I didn't take this story too seriously at all. Because I remembered it with such affection. This was a great story. Well, I'll let you finish your synopsis, and then we can chat about it.
Well, I'm already off on a rant, but okay. So she ends up falling asleep, and he's laying down next to her. So he decides to I guess he's more than copping a feel. He's I think he's going to rape this girl. But that doesn't matter, because as she starts to struggle and maybe tell him no, really what's happening is the blob is now under the raft and seeps through and grabs a hold of her face. And so he takes that opportunity of since the blob is eating the girl he was trying to rape, he jumps. I can't summarize without editorializing at this point, because it pissed me off so much. He decides to make a run for it and swims as hard as he can. And the blob kind of comes after him, but he beats it. He gets up on the shore. He turns around. He starts swearing at the blob. And then in the best part of this whole movie, the blob then jumps up on the shore and gets him. So, ha ha ha, everybody's dead.
And then there's the little fade into the brush next to where they park, with a warning not to swim in the lake.
But only after the blob burps, which also ticked me off.
I didn't even notice that. That's
yes,
great.
Yes, they could have left out the burp. Just, in fact, there's no way I would want anybody to really watch this movie anyway, but if I was, I would actually do them a favor and edit the audio so I just got rid of that burp. That's all it would have needed.
There were so many awesome things about the story. The first was character development was strictly narrowed down to names. I mean, the jock dude's name was Deek. The horny rapist dude's name was Randy. You had the Laverne and you had the Rachel. I remember this story quite a bit, even 25 years later. One of the things that really stuck with me was when the blob thing got Deek. It came up through the gaps in the wood slats that made up the raft, and it just broke, it yanked him down with such force that it pulled him through and broke the wood and pulled him so hard that it actually snapped his leg at the hip, so that it was comically like pressing up against his face as it was dragging him down into the lake.
And that's the part that my daughter saw this morning. Just that little snip.
And so, now you know that will stay with her for her life.
Yeah. Well, I had to tell her that, No, it's just a story, and it was a monster. And she's like, "Is he going to be okay?" I said, "Yeah, he's fine. He's an actor. He's doing great." And that's when I turned it off.
He was never seen again. But yeah, I mean, you had even before that, the shock of how quickly the Rachel was snagged and killed by the blob. That was great. I mean,
oh yeah, you didn't expect it. That's.
Yeah, and you know, this story certainly didn't, it's not a great movie, but one of the good things about it is, for the most part, maybe with the exception of Old Seafood and Head, it didn't really waste your time. It kept things moving. So when Randy and Laverne are left, just the two of them, to hang out on the raft with the blob underneath them, thinking that if they stay on the wood and don't expose any of their body parts to the gaps, that they'll be safe. Which makes no sense in the context of the end of the story, where the blob can just jump up and get you. When they get tired and he lays her down, 10-year-old Drew was jazzed that, he got to see boobs.
Oh, yeah, no, there was definitely that. Great. But but yeah, this wasn't
at the time I didn't understand the sort of horror convention that, whenever you see a topless chick that, someone's going to die a horrible death. So that actually did provide me a shock when we were watching it in the theater, and I just found it comical upon rewatch. These characters are so far from any sort of fleshed out, realistic seeming people that, you know, I didn't begrudge Randy for being a rapist. I thought he was just horny Randy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got a point there. In the story, it's a little more fleshed out, and if you pardon the pun, and, you know, instead of the, you know, where as Deke is jumping in the water, Randy has to yell out, "Hey, you'll stop your heart and you'll die." And then turns to Laverne and says, "I know that because I'm pre-med." It's like, "Hello, Major Exposition reporting for duty, sir." Stop. It doesn't even matter that he's pre-med because it doesn't come up in the story anymore in the movie. It makes no sense.
Yeah, and if they had just listened to Deke in the first place and swam back to the car after it eaten Rachel and it was all full and digesting, the other three probably would have lived.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was surprised, actually, frankly, on the... maybe because I'm used to living in a cold climate where your battery doesn't last very long if you just leave your radio on. But they had tunes for the entire story. They left the door open in the car with the radio on. It's like, that is a serious battery in that car.
Well, maybe back then there wasn't much of a draw on the battery.
I guess.
Not very many electronics in the car.
I suppose, but yeah.
But yeah, the shock at the end, when the blob jumped up and got Randy, that also got me when we were in the theater. I thought that was a little unfair. At that point, Randy was the big winner. He got to cop a feel, and he made it to the beach.
Oh yeah, no, but I thought it was a great way to end the story. I mean, I like the fact that, except for the burp, I like the fact that, you know, it got a final twist in there.
That's real. I did not notice the burp at all.
It was like a fart in church. It was horrible. No, it was like a stick in my eye. That's what it was. Okay, but yeah, so we definitely have divergent views of that. Oh, look, like I said, I'll have to revisit the story because I remember liking the story quite a bit. Because it was just one of those things, again, where nothing is explained and nothing has to be explained. It's a short story.
Yeah, another fun part about the story, on my rewatch, I was watching it on my iPad on a plane in the middle seat.
Oh, excellent. So, oh, by the way, did you happen to research Laverne at all?
No.
Do you know what Laverne's name is?
No.
Laverne's name is Jeremy.
The actress's name is Jeremy?
Yes, yes. The actress was is actually a twin. She was a doublement twin with her sister. I don't, of course, have her last name on here. But yeah, her first name is Jeremy. So I'm like, when I'm looking her up, I'm like, wow, I wonder if this is some sort of gender reassignment surgery person and, you know, well, good for her or whatever, him, I guess, whatever. No, just that she probably had a sister named Jennifer or something and they were twins.
Don't ruin it for me.
No, not at all. No, it was fine. Yeah, she never did anything after that either, after being, you know, a doublement twin. And if you go on IMDb under Creepshow 2, you'll find that the guy, I think his name is like Daniel Beer or something, he played Randy, and he, because somebody made some comments on IMDb about the movie, I think he started a Facebook page just based on that, saying, "Hey, I'll put my name on Facebook, and you can ask me questions about this movie." And he's got lots of stills from the movie on his Facebook page, and he posts pictures of his residual checks from his small role in Point Break and his role in Creepshow 2 and some other stuff.
Oh, poor Randy.
I know. It's poor Randy. It's, yeah, Randy's poor guy. Anyway,
One last thing about this story. There was a fun callback. I don't know if you noticed. I think one of the girls had a shirt that said Horlicks University.
Okay.
Which was the same university that was stamped on the crate from the first movie.
I did not notice that. That's excellent. That's
yeah. I actually had a note from the first movie about Horlicks University because they featured it very prominently, and I wondered if that was like a Stephen King thing that I didn't know about.
Yeah,
but maybe not.
I don't think so, but yeah, no. I'm happy they had some, you know, some reverence for the first movie. So then we have another segment of the wraparound story that won't die. Oh, by the way, when I was watching this, I was thinking, I wonder if the actor, the boy that played Billy in this one, got paid a whole lot less because he had no speaking part in it. Because all the speaking happens when he's a cartoon. So I think they cheaped out on that. On his way back from the post office, and after he read The Raft, Billy is ambushed by a gang of neighborhood bullies who harass him and take his package away. The gang's leader, apparently his name is Rhino, although I didn't notice that in the thing. He opens up the package and smashes it. Billy then kicks him in the groin and flees with the gang in hot pursuit, and they're all on their little bicycles. And then it's the intro to the last story, which is The Hitchhiker. And by the way, at least what my note is, at least there's some tension now in the wraparound. There's finally something to, you know, to say, well, maybe I want to find out what happens to Billy now.
No. No, you don't.
Okay, well, yeah, okay. As it turns out. Okay, so then we get The Hitchhiker. And the quick synopsis of this is an adulterous businesswoman played by Lois Childs, has just ended her appointment with her gigolo and it needs to get home before her husband gets home. So she hops into her Mercedes and drives home. She accidentally kills a hitchhiker. And since no one saw her do this, she just drives off before anybody does see it. She drives off. Then anyway, so she thinks she's killed this hitchhiker. Turns out she hasn't. He keeps popping up. She does more and more ridiculous things to try to kill him because he's hanging on the outside of her car and whatnot. Finally, she smashes the car into a tree in the middle of some woods. She then passes out, wakes up, thinks she's now killed him or that she's maybe even had this whole dream thing, drives home and parks in the garage, at which point she finds out that he's still there. And then she screams, and then it cuts to her husband coming home and finding her dead of carbon monoxide poisoning in the garage. And the hitchhiker sign that the sign the hitchhiker was holding that says Dover on it is now around her neck, and like in her lap. So it's sort of a morality tale there. And the biggest part of the whole thing was the hitchhiker, whenever he appears outside her car when she's driving, says, "That's the wrong lady!" And that's the thing that keeps being repeated. So that's my synopsis of that. What's your take on this one?
When we watched this in the theater, I thought it was really terrifying. Especially since we had to drive home in the way dark, because it gets dark up here in Alaska pretty early, and before there's any snow on the ground, it stays really, really dark. So I remember just being really creeped out by this story. I mean, there wasn't much to it. Upon rewatch, there are a couple interesting things that didn't seem to get answered. She did kill the hitchhiker. There was sort of an unnecessary scene after she left the scene where a trucker and another Good Samaritan sort of stop and see the body of the hitchhiker. And then it cuts to her, you know, several miles down the road, encounters what has to be his vengeful ghost or personified spirit somehow, telling her thanks for the ride. And every time she sees him, he's more mangled because she keeps running him over or smashing him against something. But just the voice and the relentlessness, it was really creepy. And again, upon rewatch, his voice sounded really familiar to me, so I had to look up who it was. And it turns out he had a reoccurring role on Seinfeld as one of Costanza's co-workers at the Yankees.
I had no idea.
Which I'm glad I didn't realize when I was actually watching Seinfeld as it was airing, because that would have been terrifying to me.
Yeah, I'm sure. Or you'd just be thinking that he, instead of saying, "Thanks for the ride, lady," he was just calling her Coco instead of T-Bone or whatever.
Maybe. But yeah, I mean, upon rewatch, this wasn't a great story. It was way more comical than scary. But it still sort of evoked that nostalgic sense of dread that I've carried with me ever since we saw it the first time.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, you and I had a experience when I think we were driving home from juggling one night. Again, it was like, must have been autumn or early winter, but there wasn't any snow on the, oh, I know what it was. Must have been like late summer, but it was really rainy, and it was dark, and it was because for the most part, our street light seemed to be set up, at least on the highway, so just anticipating snow on the ground, because during the winter time when there's snow on the ground, it's pretty easy to see when you're driving along. But when there's no snow on the ground and it's dark, there's not a lot of lights going on, and your headlights don't do very much. So, you know, it was really rainy. We must have hit something. Something hit the car as we were driving along. And we had that moment of, I didn't see what it was. And, you know, it didn't sound like a box full of kittens. I wonder if it was a cat or, I don't know, some kid on a bicycle or, So, you know, I think I drove you home, and then I had to drive back thinking, ah, crap. Am I going to have to, like, stop along the highway and see if I hit anything? Although it turns out I think we checked the car, and the car didn't have anything on it, so God knows what it was.
We did check the car.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny. Yeah, after whatever you ran over, we sort of drove the rest of the way home in silence. I think we'd been in a pretty good mood before that, but, yeah. And this had to have been at least 5 or maybe 7 years after we saw Creepshow 2 in the theater. Maybe it was a long time later.
You know what? I don't think so. Well, no, hold on. It was 87, so it was, yeah, it was 4 years, I think. Because I think Juggling Time was like 1991-ish. So you're right, yeah. So it was like, yeah, it was a long time after to remember the Thanks for the Ride Lady thing.
Yeah, and...
But we both thought about it. I mean, I remember.
Yeah, obviously the story resonated with us. It was on our mind 4 years later when you ran over some poor creature.
Or a box of kittens. The only notes I had on this, Lois Charles, who plays the wife, the driver of the car, the lady, do you know who she is?
No.
She was Dr. Holly Goodhead from Moonraker.
Never seen Moonraker.
Yeah, well, it's not great. And then the gigolo, I was certain, I was dead certain that the gigolo was Nathan Fillion.
No way.
Yeah,
that was not him.
Yeah, well, no, it wasn't, as it turns out. But I was like, holy crap, how old is Nathan Fillion? But no, it wasn't. Just had a guy with a similar haircut, that was all. You know, I guess I wanted to like the whole movie better than I did. I didn't, as it turns out, I don't really recommend it. There's not much there.
No, if you don't have any sort of nostalgia for this movie because you saw it in the theater when you were way too young and you're tag along with your older brother, there's no reason to watch this movie.
Okay, I agree. Oh, just to finish the, since we spoiled it, we might as well spoil the wraparound. So Billy, who is now being chased by the bullies, Billy and the bullies, anyway, he's flying along on his bicycle. And by the way, none of this is live action. It's all a cartoon. This whole wraparound from the very beginning, except for the very first scene, is all cartoon. So they get, they're gaining on him. They finally are going to catch up with him, but you find out that he has lured them to this sort of, I guess, abandoned property that has a little cul-de-sac with nothing there. The street just, the dirt road just stops. He skids his bike around to face them. They're going to, do him some bodily damage. And then these gigantic Venus flytraps come and eat them all. The end. So, what do you know? He's had the Venus flytrap bulbs. This must have been this wasn't his first purchase of these things, apparently.
So terrible.
Yeah, absolutely terrible. So, that is a big not recommend. I highly recommend Creepshow. I don't recommend Creepshow 2.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. If you have a rant or rave, please send your email to rant@notincreepyway.com.
Like us on Facebook. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Leave a comment. Turns out you can leave a 5-star rating and the comment could say your show sucks, and it still makes us happy. We're doing this for fun, and we're doing this a little bit for posterity, but we also want to be entertaining, so if you're entertained by this, let us know, and that'll buoy us along quite a bit. Thank you for listening, and I wish you a wonderful week, but not in a creepy way.